Right on. All right, recording in progress. My name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 3rd, 2009. So, God willing, and a little work on my end, I should have 17 years of continuous sobriety here in a week or two. Yeah, like Jim explained, that was the story that got me here to this morning. I didn't know when I woke up yesterday morning that I'd be speaking on a meeting this morning, but AA step, AA calls out for volunteers to do stuff. I'm more than happy to step up and take my responsibility. And that's okay. That's the way it works, I don't know, I've spoken a lot over the years, and sometimes when you have a lot of weeks to think about what you're going to say, you screw it up a lot in your head, and this works out perfect. So this means I'll say exactly what God intended me to say this morning and to provide the proper message. First of all, I want to add one person to that prayer list. I was thinking about it after we got going through that yesterday at the assembly. We had a member that had to be transported out in a ambulance. Mary Jo C, I think, is her last initial. I'm not positive, but most of us know Mary Jo in the North Towns area,
Yeah,
and
Mary Jo P, and thanks for bringing that up.
she had some incident. We're not sure what happened, but doesn't matter. She got hauled out in an ambulance, and I understand she was at the hospital at least overnight. So we'll add her to that prayer list. Not sure the situation, but doesn't matter. Our prayers are what matter. So, I love that foreword that you guys read at the beginning of the meeting. That just really, I think that's what I needed to hear this morning. I think that's one of the reasons I was here, because I'll get to this in my story, but I've gotten like uber involved with service over the last 2 or 3 years of my time in AA, and the primary purpose of why I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous has at times gotten a little blurred in my head. The bottom line is, I have to be here to help the next suffering alcoholic. Yes, all the service work to maintain and make sure that AA is there for that person is imperative to do. But the bottom line is, I got to prepared to share my message with another alcoholic and to help that person discover the recovery and the miracle that I've gotten to enjoy and live for the last almost 17 years of my life. So that's a good message for me to hear, because every now and then I forget that, and I know I'm doing important work with everything else I do, but I got to remember that first and foremost, because that's why I'm sober today, 17 years later, because I had guys in my fellowship early on that helped me with that. So, when I speak in front of a group of alcoholics, it's imperative that I qualify myself as an alcoholic. I don't like to spend a whole lot of time on my story. It's nothing extravagant. It's nothing elaborate. It's nothing unique. It is what it was, And but I don't have any great accomplishments in what I was still drinking, accomplishments in the sense of I didn't get DUIs, I didn't see jail time, I didn't see any of that. But I know today that if I don't keep what I'm doing what I'm doing, due to the progressive nature of our disease, all that stuff is, I'm eligible for all of it, and I'll find it all. I know that. It terrifies me when I learn that our disease keeps progressing even when we're not contributing to it, and to think of how I was drinking 17 years ago right now, right at the end, to think that that would continue to progress and be worse today than it was then, it'd be lethal. My drinking took me to the point of where I was consuming about a half of a 175 a day in bourbon and sprinkling in other things. And that's just lethal amounts of alcohol that I was pouring in my body, because I was such an unhappy, miserable individual, and I couldn't stand myself and I couldn't stand everybody else around me. And that's where my drinking took me. And to think that it would progress beyond that, I wouldn't make it a week, So I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, I can assure you that. So anyways, my story starts, give you a little background. I was born in Lansing, Michigan, and that's where I grew up. My father was a Korean War veteran, and he was a engineer at Oldsmobile in Lansing, Michigan. So he was a white collar, educated, accomplished individual. And my mother was a stay at home mom who loved to intervene in her kids' lives very, very much so. But that's the era I grew up in, the 70s. And I have a sister that's a couple years older than me. Our relationship's a little estranged right now. I've tried to repair that. This program has taught me how to do that, and it's on her end at this point, but keep working at it. But nonetheless, my early days, I was not around alcohol at all. My parents didn't drink. If they drank, they didn't do it around me. I didn't know them to drink. I didn't have relatives that were heavy drinkers or anything like that. If our disease is genetic and it comes from somewhere in your past, I don't know where it came from in my past. I don't really worry about that because I got what I got, But I was almost sheltered from alcohol, and the opinions that my parents had of people who drank, not even abusively, but just drank, they had a strong opinion against it. So bottom line was, I didn't test the waters when I was a kid. I was one of those kids that was probably constantly seeking approval from my parents. And I did what I was told to do. I followed the rules. I was generally a pretty good kid. I had a lot of expectations put on me from my parents to get good grades and to be actively involved in a lot of activities. And the expectation was to go to college and do all that. And it didn't prevent me from turning into a pretty miserable kid. And I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted to do it my way. And if I'm trying to conform to their rules, I couldn't do things my way, So it just made me pretty unhappy. And looking back on it today, I don't see why I had any reason to have an unhappy childhood. I just did, I just chose to be that kid. I was also one of those ones that didn't really fit in with any crowd. I was pretty much a lone wolf. I had a couple friends, but I didn't do a whole lot of social activities. A Friday night for me was Saturday night was going over to my friend's house, and we'd sit in the basement and listen to Rush and play Dungeons and Dragons, and that was our night, I have a lifelong love of Rush. I don't play Dungeons and Dragons anymore, I can assure you that. But that was how socially involved I was, but I went away to college and went to University of Michigan, proud alum. And I discovered alcohol that very first weekend I was there. I loved it. Oh my God. I drank alcoholically that first night. I think I drank into a blackout. I drank ridiculous amounts of alcohol that first night. And I knew, I hated the next morning, but I knew I'd be doing it real quick again. And that was my habit for a lot of years. I drank heavily on the weekends, but I could shut it off for the week when I had schoolwork to do, class to go to, and all that. But when you're at a, university like that, I mean, it's any college, but I mean, it was the drinking culture was a heavy part of the culture in Ann Arbor for University of Michigan, and we had big time football to go to, and that's what you did on the weekends, and I took part in it, and I can trace back, I can see like my obsession over drinking. I can see that starting then. Because I'd always obsess through the week, when are we going to drink? Who's getting the stuff? Where are we going to do it? I was kind of the organizer of it, and I could see that obsession kicking in really early back then. But for a lot of those years and into my 20s, alcohol didn't get in the way of what I was doing. I mean, I drank abusively. I always drank differently than everybody. I could see that. There was never enough. One of three things would occur at the end of the night. It was like I was either out of time, I was out of alcohol, or I was out of money. It was one of those three. And that's how the trend worked for a lot of years. And it wasn't really getting in the way of much. I graduated from there. I went on to graduate school at the University of Cincinnati. And early 20s at this point, 22, 23 or something. And I was a legal drinker in the bars. So that opened up that whole window. And I loved that life, man. That lifestyle was chaotic, and I loved it. Getting into the bars and just being around the chaos. And my drinking started to elevate to more daily, you know. It didn't have a grip on me yet. I still had control of it, but it was a daily thing. And even around 23, 24 years old, I could see I was drinking way more than I should be. And I tried a period of abstinence from it. Non-alcoholic beer was a new thing at that point. This is the early 90s. And I remember I switched to that for about 4 months. And you know, I'd go out and I'd have like 10 NA beers. I mean, you know, just ridiculous ideas that I later learned in AA that non-alcoholic beers is for non-alcoholics. I later learned that, but I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know what it was. And of course I went back to drinking and it was far worse than it was before. So I already was learning the lessons of progression and I didn't even know anything about it. But you know, like I said, it didn't get in the way. I was getting my shit done. You know, I got my master's degree. I started doctoral work. I was working in my field already, and along the way, I found some woman to put up with my bullshit, co-sign my bullshit, and you know, and I look back on that period of time too, and it was like I was under the spell of alcohol and my alcoholic thinking and my alcoholic tendencies, and I was making decisions that I wouldn't make today, you know. And choosing a partner, that's one of those decisions that I made then that I would not have made today. I don't mean in the sense of not choosing a partner to spend time with, because I'm married to somebody now that not the first one, but I'm just the point being I was making a decision to marry somebody that would co-sign my bullshit and allow me to live my life the way I wanted to live it and not contribute into a healthy adult relationship, you know. And I look back on that decision. I didn't choose to marry a bad person. I just didn't marry the right person for how I was going to live my life later in life, in my 40s and my 50s. But I spent time trying to repair that. I'll get to that down the road. But I, you know, life took a turn, and I moved up here year 2000. I was still drinking, of course, and drinking heavily, and I fit into the culture a lot better in this region. I'm not blaming it on you guys, but this was a good place for me to live for drinking, you know. And I elevated my amount of time I was spending with alcohol, and it just got so much worse. It got so much worse. My 30s were just awful. I was working in my field already, working at my current job. I've been there for 26 years, and that workplace has seen me at my worst and they've seen me at my best now. And somehow I didn't lose it. But my drinking definitely held my career back. I know that. I have to live with that today. I had greater aspirations than where I'm at today. I'll tell you what I do. I'm a musician in the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra, and I had goals and dreams to be elsewhere. And my drinking definitely held back the best years of my career advancement. I know that. I'm happy where I am today, but I could have been someplace better, you know. And that's what my drinking did, you know. It held back goals that I had in life, and it held back good decision making that I would not have made if it weren't for the condition I was living under. But we'll fast forward, you know, towards the end of my 30s, I was a daily drinker. I don't know where I crossed that line. I don't know where I at one point I crossed a line where I didn't have any control over whether or not I was going to drink. It's just I was drinking, and it was daily, and it turned into just abusive amounts, as I talked about earlier. And I just couldn't keep living like I was living, you know. Suicide was an option. I had a plan. I couldn't carry it out. My plan was to drive off. I lived down in Hamburg at the time, and my plan was to, for those that are in the area, I mean, my plan was to drive down Route 5 and blast off into 18 Mile Creek. You know, that was a good way to go. Painless, simple, easy, and it would have worked. And I couldn't do it. Too chicken shit to even do that right. And but that's where my life was, and I couldn't keep living like I was. My job was my identity. I hated what I did, and I hated everybody and everything around me. And had to make changes. Had to make changes. Thank God I came into contact with somebody who had experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me their story. They told me they were doing service work for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know this. They were doing what the forward talked about. It was one alcoholic talking to another, right? But I didn't know I was an alcoholic at the time. I just kind of thought I couldn't stop drinking, you know. But this person was telling me what this program did for them, and I was like, man, that sounds like an option, you know. I was at the point where I didn't have any control over whether I was going to drink or not tomorrow or today, but I did have control still over, I had a little willpower left to try and make some changes in my life. That's about all I had left. And I thought, well, let's give it a shot because I can't keep doing what I'm doing, you know. So I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on February 2nd or 3rd. I can't remember how I set my anniversary date, whatever. It was right in there. I went to my first meeting. It was a Monday morning meeting in Hamburg, old timers meeting. And I remember rolling in there day after the Super Bowl. I remember that. I tied it on really good the night before. And I remember walking in that room and it was like all these old people in there. And you know, and now I'm on the older end, not super old, but you know, it just didn't visually, it didn't appeal to me right off the bat. And thank God I found a table where there was a couple men sitting there that were more my age. I sat down with those guys and I remember asking the guy next to me, who ended up being my first sponsor, Chris W, who's a longtime member of AA. I asked him, why is everybody in such a good mood in here? Why is everybody laughing? And he's like, because we don't look like you. You know, and he could tell I was pretty beat up, and he knew I was, you know, I'd already told him it was my first meeting, and I was like, well, fuck you, man. I don't look that bad. I don't look as bad as, you know, but whatever. I get what he was saying now. I didn't get it at the time. But thank God I sat there and I had two men that I became friends with, two men that I started a fellowship with, and adding other men to that fellowship. And I went to Chris, I asked Chris to be my first sponsor. And, you know, Chris only ended up being my sponsor for about a year, but he's still a dear friend in fellowship to me, you know, and he's still sober, and we're in touch, you know. And I was just starting those little roots, those little seedlings of fellowship and recovery. And I'll talk about how important fellowship is to me down the road here. But he encouraged me to come to his home group that week, and it was Thursday night men's sobriety discussion in Hamburg. And I went to a couple more meetings before that, and I joined him there Thursday night at that meeting. And that was the first time I really felt that I was in a room of people that were like me, you know. People, I could really identify with the room. I could identify with the men I was getting to know there. And I could, you know, I wasn't at the point where I wanted to admit that I was an alcoholic, but you know, he encouraged me early on. He encouraged me to, why don't he, you know, he could tell I was an alcoholic, you know, even though it's self-diagnosed. And we get that ability as we spend some time around this program. You get a new person come in and it's like, you know, they're an alcoholic, but they just don't want to admit to it. And Chris was playing that role with me. He's like, he knew I was in the right place. I just had to convince myself and commit that I was in the right place. And understand that my life was, you know, I was powerless over alcohol, but I wasn't ready to admit that. I just thought I was a problem drinker. I was like, well, 12 steps, 12 meetings, I'll get this under control and we'll be good to go. Well, something odd happened. I just kept sticking around. I kept sticking around. I kept coming around. And he turned me on to a lot of his buddies and fellowship. And that really turned out to be the most important early thing that I did, was creating a fellowship. And that's where I feel fellowship is such a huge part of recovery. And the reason I put so much emphasis on fellowship is because when I'm not having a very spiritual day, it doesn't take me too long to find somebody in my core group that's having a little more spiritual day than I am. I just need to find them and I got to reach out to them, you know. And I've got those days, there's no question. I mean, it's this whole process, man. It's just it ebbs and flows, you know. I got better days than others, you know, but every day's better than I used to live. I know that. But if I'm not having a very spiritual day, I can find somebody pretty quickly that's doing a little better job that day, and then we talk to one another and we do what was discussed in that forward, you know, and we share what's going on in our lives, you know. And I get spiritual, you know. I feel that spiritual power from that person. But you know, I started getting busy in that group. That was my home group for about 14 years. I think it was about 14 years, and I'll get to the wife there later. But I started getting to be of service right off the bat. I think that first night I went there, so this is only about the fourth day I'm in AA. That's the first group I went to that even talked about joining the group. I didn't understand what that meant, but I learned it after the evening. And there was a business meeting that night, and I was a member, and I decided to stick around 4 days sober. And I took on a service commitment right off the bat because Chris had encouraged me to do that. He's like, get busy in your home group. You got to learn how to be of service. Even before you admit you're an alcoholic, he said, you learn to be of service, and then you'll grow, and you'll start understanding how we live and how we work in this program, you know? And so I took on a very simple role. I remember I was a greeter at the door, and I couldn't for the life of me understand how just shaking people's hands as they were walking into a meeting, how's that going to get me sober? How does that service work? You know, and little did I know, I'm like starting to build kind of the three legacies of recovery, you know, or of our program right off the bat. You know, I'm building a fellowship around me, which is the unity. And I'm being of service because I'm putting myself out there, and I'm forcing myself to meet new people, and I'm showing people that I'm responsible, and I'm showing people that I can be counted on, and I'm showing people that you know, they can rely on me to show up next week and complete this service task again. And all that builds on the recovery. You know, recovery's at the bottom of our triangle. That's the foundation that we grow around here, and it's the three legacies that build everything, you know. And I was making it happen that first week, and I had no idea I was doing it. It was like this, you know, if it's a cult, man, I'm more than happy to say I'm a member of a cult at this point, you know. But it did look a little cultish to me at first, but today I view it as a cult to save my life, you know. But I was building it right off the bat. And fast forward a few months into this, maybe about 3 months, I was definitely ready to start doing the work. You know, if I could look back on my time in this program and do some things differently, I think I would start going through the book a little sooner, because I suffered a long time. I've suffered a good 6 to 12 months without a drink. And the reason for that is because I was still a raging alcoholic in my mind, and I was resentful. I was guilty of all the isms, but I wasn't drinking any longer. So all this stuff stirred up in my head, and I wasn't doing anything about it. I didn't have any alcohol to pour on my body to shut that off. And I suffered a long time. I remember my first wife at the time, who I went to early sobriety with. I remember her telling me, he's like, why don't you just go back out and drink? You were a lot happier person when you were drinking, you know, because I was miserable. It got worse. And I will be the first to say that it got worse before it got better. But I finally had committed to the fact that I was an alcoholic, that I wanted to do something about it in this program, and I wanted to use the program to get better, to get healthier. And the only way to do that was to go through the book one-on-one with a sponsor. My sponsor at the time, Chris, who I'd mentioned, he was going through divorce. He was starting a new business. He was crazy busy with a lot of stuff. And his suggestion was, you know, about the only time we could find a meet was, why don't we get together at like 5 in the morning before he has to start his day? And I'm like, I don't think I want to get that sober, you know. And that was not my time schedule, but you know, I wanted to do things. So we brainstormed it a bit, and he's like, why don't you find another sponsor who will take you, or at least another person who will take you through the book. And it was a friend of mine I already had in fellowship. And so we did that. I never really moved on. I didn't really tell Chris he wasn't my sponsor any longer, but I had a new sponsor. I had him give him like my 8-year coin many years later, and I finally said to him, I was like, Chris, I hate to tell you this now, but you're not my sponsor. It took me 8 years to tell him that, but I think he figured it out a long time before that. But anyways, I got together with my next sponsor, and we started going through the book, and that's where the miracle happened. That's where it happened. We diligently went through that book on Monday nights at his house in Orchard Park for about a year, maybe longer. And we just meticulously went through that book. He shared his experience. He got my feedback on what we were reading and what my experiences w was with what we were reading about and how it looked in my life and how it looked in my background. And we had the I had the experience, I had the spiritual experience, and I can see now that he had the spiritual experience too, because I've had that experience with men I've taken through the book, when the light bulb finally comes on and the pop comes out of the backside and they get it figured out, and what a miracle that is. And that's exactly what that foreword is talking about that you guys read, love it. Where our primary purpose is to share this message with other men and women, but other people in this program, and allow them to experience what I've experienced, and that's the miracle. But I had that experience. There were no, burning bushes or no levitating or nothing like that, but we got to the core of the problem. The core of the problem was me. I think we've all figured that out, most of us. And I made the proper changes, and I found a spiritual foundation to build on with this program and to build my life on. And I did the 12 steps. I've made my amends. And so things went pretty well with my amend making when I did it. I had a couple that were, I had a lot to make, but I had a couple that didn't go as positively as I'd hoped. But that's, as long as I cleaned up my side of the street, I was taught that how somebody else reacts to it, what other people's opinion of me is none of my business. As long as I've done my best to repair the damage I've done in the past, then that's what matters. And it was an incredible experience because so many people were so happy to receive what I was telling them, and it was it really made it feel like this was all worth it, and I made a decision at that point too. I made those amends with my wife, and I'd put her, what I decided was I'd put her through 9 years of hell with my drinking while we were married. I decided to give, I was already at the point where I didn't feel like she was the right spouse for me moving forward, but I wanted to work on repairing that marriage. We had too much time invested together. I cared too much for her to not give it some effort. And I made a decision to, I don't know if this is the right decision, but this is the decision I made. I decided to give my marriage 9 years in recovery. I felt like I owed her the same amount of time I put her through hell to try and repair this. And that's the decision I made. And I stuck to it. I gave it a good solid 8, 9 years in recovery until I decided to make the decision to move on, and that's a part of my story a little later. But I had that experience. I had that spiritual experience as a result of the work I'd done on these 12 steps, and I was content with where things were, But I didn't stop. I didn't stop. I always had a service commitment in that first home group. And the interesting thing with service for me was it was all my, I don't think I've had more than a couple weeks of my time around this program without some type of service position. Well, that's not accurate, but I've generally always had a service position of some sort in my home group. But that it was all limited to the home group. I didn't understand that there were service opportunities within the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous outside of the home group. That's all I knew. And I was at a home group where they didn't really, I mean, they were active outside, a very large group, if you're familiar with it, and very active, but there wasn't a whole lot of people that were active outside of the home group. And I was certainly one of those, but I was a definite member of that group in service to that group. And I took on over the years, I took on pretty much every service opportunity that that group needed other than GSR. I never did the GSR service role there, but I took on a lot of important responsibilities, treasurer. I was anniversary chair for about 10 years, which that's another thing. That group didn't know anything about the spirit of rotation. So I sat in that position for 10 years. My nickname was Daniversary, because I had that micromanaged to a T, and it's funny how I got into that role to begin with. We were at a business meeting. I was about a year sober, and I got bitching about how the anniversary chair was like sometimes we wouldn't have the proper coins for people. And, so, for an example, if somebody had a 5-year anniversary coming up or on that day and we didn't have a 5-year coin, they just give them a 4-year and a 1-year to add it up to a 5. And I was like, nah, that's bullshit. I mean, you never know what that act might do to somebody who's receiving a coin. That might piss them off to the point and get them resentful to the point where they go back out drinking. And somebody else spoke up and he's like, well, it looks like we got our new anniversary chair. So I took on the role, man, and I micromanaged the hell out of it. And I'll guarantee this, I never gave out 2 coins to one person. It was always the proper one. And I was in that for a long time. And lots of other roles. The important thing is I was being of service. I had the fellowship around me that I had developed as a result of the work I'd done early on and being an active member in that group. I had dozens of guys that, were basically my co-sponsor. I always had that one person that was a sponsor, but I had dozens of guys in my camp, and I was building that foundation of recovery. So I was on the surface living a program of the three legacies, let me fast forward a little bit. How much time do we got here anyways? 15 minutes, perfect. Life changed, life changed in the later years of my being a member of that group. My mother passed away about 6 years ago. That was a tough one. That was a tough one. I did finally get to the point where I decided I needed to move on from that first marriage. I had given it enough time in recovery. I had given it a great effort at trying to make it better. We'd been in therapy. We'd done couples therapy. We'd done everything we could, but I had changed too much as a person for her to see that or for her to feel that she was still married to the same person. And we made that tough decision. I guess I kind of made it that it was just time to move on because we just turned into that couple where we were roommates, and that was it, housemates, living on each other's health insurance and earnings, and that was that. We didn't have any kids, and it was going to be an easy split, and it was the right move to make, but that was a tough thing to go through nonetheless, and recovery. And I moved out and I got an apartment on my own. That was the first time I'd been renting in a long time. And that was a tough adjustment. And then a year after that, I bought my own house and I moved to West Seneca. I wanted to stay closer to the South towns because that's where my roots were in AA. And that was tricky. That was tricky, man. It's like I'm 100% responsible for the existence of this house. And that was tough. I mean, I could afford it, but it's still unnerving when it's all on you. And that challenged my recovery, no question about it. All those events challenged my recovery. And then COVID hit. Then COVID hit. And that was, I look back on that period of time, that was one of the great periods of time in my life because I really got reconnected with AA. I mean, I was pretty active up to that point, but I really got reactive, much more active back in it. And many more meetings I was going to. God, even that first weekend, I remember I found an online meeting out in Seattle because they were a couple of weeks ahead of us in the COVID situation, and I knew they'd have some meetings online. I found a group out there that I loved. Name of the group? Oh God, why can't I remember this? Because it's the best. It's the greatest thing. I'll come up with it as we go ahead here. But anyways, I made a commitment to that group. And I was there every Sunday night and loved it. And I made a new fellowship out in the Northwest, and I ended up joining that group because they needed some help with some service stuff just to keep the online aspect of it going. And I had another home group out in Seattle, and that was awesome. I made a great fellowship. I did book studies on the side with these new members of my fellowship, and it was incredible. And the best thing, I got to, I never met these people until I had the opportunity to go out to Vancouver last summer for the international convention, and I got to meet three people that I had built these bonds with in the Seattle area because they were right down the road from from Vancouver. And what a great experience that was to meet these people. And I remember the first thing one of the women said to me, she's like, "I didn't realize you were so tall. I mean, you can't ever tell how tall people are on Zoom, you know? And I'm quite tall." And it was funny. But what a great experience COVID was with that situation. And something happened with too, and it really changed my service footprint. I wasn't working in the orchestra. It ended up being like 18 months that I was off. I got paid the whole time, so finances were never an issue because we got a union contract. But I didn't work. And when COVID first hit and they told you to stay at home and isolate, I was like, man, sign me up. Loved it, absolutely loved it. It's like, oh, you want me to stay at home with my two cats in West Seneca and isolate? Sign me up. And I got about 2 months into that, and I realized, no, this is not healthy for me. I had to find something to do, and this is where my service mentality came forefront in my head. I had always been a strong proponent of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, but people along the way had taught me to be of service outside of Alcoholics Anonymous also. And outside, in the sense of like out in the real world, not necessarily being of service to alcoholics, being of service to society, to the community. And I learned that that was an important thing to do because I was, I would happily spread my cheer back in the days when I was drinking with people out in the community that I never knew personally, but I just acted like an idiot, in front of these people. And it was just kind of a simple way to make amends, living amends out in the community. So I decided, all right, I got to find something else to do here. And I DoorDashed for a couple of months. That was a joke because I learned it's a game and you're not making any money. So, but it got me out of the house. So at least I felt like I was providing some type of service that people needed, But the real service decision I made was like, all right, where can I be of help that's desperately needed, and I can be of service. And I fell into, of all things, I fell into school bus driving, and I started working on getting my license and going through all the training and all that stuff. And I eventually became a school bus driver in West Seneca schools where I was living. And the funny thing is, once I went back full time at the other job, it's like I learned I can juggle all this, It's not ideal, but I can juggle it. I can maintain this service work that I've become to, and I've come to enjoy, and that I feel it's, I get more reward out of doing that, honestly, than doing the other job that I've been training, I've been working in my entire career. And it does seem like really great service work to me because it's so vitally needed, And I've turned that position. I'm still doing it, and I'm still doing both. And I take that money that I earn there, and I'm of service to my stepkids. I mean, what a concept that is. Because I have remarried now. I found a woman who has supported everything about me and everything about my recovery. And we've built a beautiful life together. And she's brought two kids into my life. I mean, they're in their 20s. So that was a lot easier than dealing with it before, longer before, like most people have to. But nonetheless, this allows me to be of service there, and I can help them out financially. In ways that my parents helped me, and it's another way of me giving back to people that I love, and that's where my outside service has gone, and I'm just grateful. That's not the type of person I am, at my core. I am today, but I wasn't at my core to be that type of person. Let's jump back to service in AA before I close out here. So about 3 years ago, I got married like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. Oh God, I hope she's not hearing me. Hold on, 21, October of 20, shit. We've been married 5 years, I think, 4 or 5, somewhere in there. I'm keeping it on the down low here so I don't get in trouble. She's upstairs. So I decided to move to her house. She owned a house in Grand Island. She works on the island, and I didn't want to put her in a commute situation, so I agreed to move out here reluctantly and sold my house in West Seneca and changed my footprint in AA pretty greatly, really quickly. I maintained my home group in Hamburg, but after long days at work and everything, I'm getting up at 4:30 in the morning and driving to West Seneca, doing that job, bouncing over to the orchestra in the middle, coming back to West Seneca to do that, running home for dinner. I wasn't going back down to Hamburg too often for my home group any longer. And I wasn't attending business meetings there, so I didn't have any service role in the group any longer. So there was a little period where I wasn't of service in that sense. And after about a year of bouncing around doing that, skipping my home group every other week, and for only good reason is I'm tired, I finally, I was talking to my sponsor about it, and he's like, you got to make a change, because if you don't make that change, your sobriety date might change, and we don't want to risk that. So I had to find a new home group, and that's when I found the How It Works men's group. I don't think I even announced that at the beginning. I apologize. So I joined the How It Works men's group in Tonawanda, Kenmore, whatever it is, and I immediately went to the first business meeting I could there, and I got a position right away. And we had alternate GSR open, so I was like, all right, time to head down that road, and I didn't think anything was going to amount of it, at least at first, because it's like, all right, I'm just the alt GSR. I'll learn how to do this, and I'll probably take it over at the next term change. And all of a sudden, our GSR, Dave, he had to he took on a position in District 4 as the treasurer, and he said, I got to vacate this because I can't have both. And so he's like, what do you feel about jumping up and taking over the GSR position? I was like, well, yeah, that's what I signed up for. So I took over the GSR role there and jumped fully in and did my responsibilities, and I loved it. And along the way, I was building a fellowship of new men that I didn't know from Northtown's meetings and from that home group. And I started meeting some of these guys that were like outside the meeting, outside the core of the meeting, in service work at the district level, at the area level, at the general service level in New York, or meaning as a delegate from Area 50. I didn't know any of this stuff. And then I remember this vital week when everything changed. I listened to that Grapevine podcast that's on the app every week. I love it. And they had a guest speaker in there. I can't remember who it was or where they were from. Doesn't matter. All I remember is the key thing that the speaker said. He started talking about a service sponsor, and this like light went on in my head. I'm like, service sponsor. I never heard that phrase in 14 years in recovery. Never heard anybody mention that word. I even rewound it just to make sure that's what I heard him say. And then he got talking about that. And I put it back in the back of my mind. It's like, all right, service sponsor, yeah, maybe that's something I need to think about. Well, then a few days later, I go to the home group Saturday morning, and somebody's getting a coin, and he talks about his service sponsor. And then I go to a table, and that same guy is at my table, and he continues to talk about his service sponsor. So this is like, one week I hear this term three times that I never heard it. So I go to one of our long-term members at that group, Chuck B, who many of us know, and I said, "What's his service sponsor? What did, can you explain this to me?" And he explained it to me, because Chuck's been uber involved in service, as those of us who know him have seen. And I was like, "Well, I got to get one of these service sponsors, because I need to dive in even deeper." So I just cut to the chase, and I asked our current delegate at the time, Steve J, to be my service sponsor. And we've been diligently going through that handbook for the last year and a half. Service manual, sorry. And it's just lighting this fire under me of service outside of the home group. And I absolutely love it. I got the chance to go out to Vancouver, as I mentioned earlier, and it really elevated out there too, just watching people of service and what they do. And I got to meet like Scott H. I had dinner with him, with a group of us, and he's the chairperson of the General Service Board. And what a ambassador to our program and recovery he is, and spirituality. If you got a chance, find his letter that he just released about the state of the money state of the state of the money situation with AA, and this message is incredible. It's an incredible message. Find it if you can. I came back, and I just wanted so much more in service. And I went to our September area assembly. down in Olean, and I had a goal of standing for the Grapevine chair position with Area 50, and I didn't end up getting that. It went multiple rounds in the vote, and I didn't end up getting it. But after I got over my 2 minute resentment of not getting that, I heard another position coming up, and this Area 50 web chair came up. Now I don't know what the hell I'm doing on a computer. I'm 56 years old. I mean, I've got some computer literacy, but I'm not that literate. But I decided I'm gonna run for this, and I did, and I got it. And it's been a whirlwind of activities since then. It, our panel starts over officially in January, but I've been handling all the responsibilities for about the last 3 months because I can't jump in January 1st and know what I'm doing. So, and yesterday was a byproduct of that, setting up all the tech work for this assembly meeting, and I was absolutely paranoid about it, terrified, but it all went well. And I learned it's been humbling because it's like I'm learning, all right, you're not the first person, you're not unique, you're not the first person in AA who's taken over service sponsor or service commitment that doesn't know what they're doing. And I'm learning, and it's just a beautiful thing, you know. Today things are just incredible in my life. I've got a wonderful marriage, I got a wonderful program, I've got a wonderful relationship with a higher power. I'm of service in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm willing to share the message with whoever asks it from me, and some that don't ask it. And I've had the miracle of recovery that I just wish we could all experience, you know. And I'm going to finish 40 seconds early. So that's all I got. I'm grateful to share with you guys. Thanks.